This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Original Gangsters, the untold story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the birth of West Coast rap. Written by Ben Westhoff. Read by J.D. Jackson. Includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of bonus material.
To Mom and Dad, for all their love. Chapter 1. The Stash. He was the trash-talking, gun-toting hustler who brought the image of the young Compton street kid, tough, aggressive, and sick of being stepped on, to the mainstream. He rose faster and changed popular music more than almost anyone else, becoming not just a performer, known for his hypnotic rap cadence, but a behind-the-scenes mogul who upset the status quo and enriched himself in the process. He aimed to shock, but his lyrics were only as exhilarating as his life itself. He was a womanizer and a family man, a devoted friend and a brutal adversary capable of the same type of violence that would come to define the music movement he launched. When he appeared on a 1993 episode of The Arsenio Hall Show, the host introduced him as the godfather of gangster rap. But back in 1985, before he became known as Eazy-E, he was Eric Wright, the 21-year-old neighborhood drug pusher. While pals from Southeast Compton slept off hangovers, Eric would often start his days early. He read the Los Angeles Times before putting on a white t-shirt and white tube socks pulled high above his blue crocus sack shoes. A pager and opaque sunglasses known as Lokes completed the look. The days tended to be bright and scorching on South Muriel Avenue, the treeless Compton street he called home. Unlike lots of other poor families in the area, his was stable. Dad worked at the post office and Mom at a Montessori school. Eric, however, didn't fly so straight. Before leaving home, he stretched his sock's elastic band with one finger and crammed in a roll of bills. "He'd keep $2,000 in his sock at all times," said Arnold Big A White, a childhood friend. "Eric has stashes of cash everywhere." He kept some in his parents' garage, and even a few dollars in the pockets of his Levi's 501s. But his sock was where he kept the bulk of his traveling cash. If someone hit him up, maybe a homeless guy or someone trying to rob him, he could simply pull out his pockets and shrug his shoulders. In the last couple of years, rap's popularity had exploded in the neighborhood, and Eric sometimes thought about getting into hip-hop. But he kept that idea mostly to himself. He focused on the game. Sure, Eric wasn't the biggest drug dealer in the area, but he was doing well. Freebased cocaine was exploding in Los Angeles. Everyone suddenly wanted this stuff. Strung out women with kids, glassy-eyed old guys walking around. Everyone. People came to Compton from miles around to get the goods. Crack would soon wreck the community, but no one really knew where things were headed just yet. Even the police didn't know what to make of this seemingly innocuous, odorless stuff.
"They would catch you with crack and just give you a slap on the wrist," said Mark Big Man Rucker, Easy's drug-dealing partner.
The influx of crack money was everywhere. Folks showed off gold chains and drove Nissan trucks, tricked out as lowriders riding on low-profile tires. But as drug dealing became increasingly lucrative, territory disputes erupted.
"Then everybody's trying to expand out," said Vince Edwards, a Compton rapper known as CPO Boss Hog. "One or two blocks is not enough. We need another neighborhood."
Eric himself didn't get high. He didn't even drink. He told friends he didn't like the taste of malt liquor, but mainly he knew sobriety gave him a mental advantage. At only 5'4" or so, he needed people to take him seriously. Though he had money and the gear that came with it,
He had all the tight cars, clothes, and all of that, said Lorenzo Patterson, his neighbor who became NWA member MC Ren. He was careful not to flaunt his wealth. He stayed low-key, wasn't flashy. He wasn't the type to talk a lot either. Sporting a jerry curl and a thin mustache, the man behind the Lokes was guarded and shy. After all, his line of work put a premium on discretion. When it came to women, however, Eric was a vivacious seducer. He had a baby boy named after himself with his girlfriend, Darnetra, who was pregnant again. And he also had another woman pregnant at the same time, named Linda.
I'm Eazy-E, I got women galore. You might have a lot of women, but I got much more,
he would later rap. Before long, he took on a steady girlfriend, Joyce, who later bore his fourth child, Derek, when Eric was 23. Joyce had diminishing degrees of success trying to keep Eric faithful, and took to calling him the community dick, because he kept getting caught with other women. One time, Joyce got so angry with him that she threw a lunchbox at Eric's head. Tracy Jernigan later became another of Eric's favorites. But when Eric got her and yet another woman pregnant at the same time, Jernigan was furious.
I was hearing from everyone. That's your boyfriend, but this other girl's pregnant, having his baby right now, she said.
Eric and Rucker, the fellow dealer, engaged in a long-running competition they called baby races to see who could get the most women pregnant. Eric would win, fathering 10 in total. Still, Eric bought Jernigan expensive gifts, including Gucci watches and a new 1989 Acura Legend. But when she arrived at his house one night and Eric wouldn't come out, she was sure she'd caught him cheating. Jernigan decided to enact revenge. She backed her Acura halfway up the block in order to get some momentum and aimed it directly at Eric's new BMW 750 IL, which was parked on the street. The idea was to get him
to come outside and just face me, she remembers thinking.
But things didn't go according to plan.
Somehow my car went up, like it lifted up almost on two wheels, she said.
When it landed, it was undrivable. The whole thing is kind of a blur from there. Eric's other woman came out and tried to tangle with her, but eventually Jernigan called Eric's sister to pick her up. Sets. Eric Wright spoiled his kids, regularly taking them to Disneyland or Chuck E. Cheese's.
When we had an outing or a weekend together, we all went, Eric Wright Jr. recalled. To us, he was the biggest and baddest thing walking.
He could also be a sadistic prankster. He'd draw a gopher out of its hole in his backyard by squirting lighter fluid down in it, and then light the animal on fire and watch it run around. He might take a giant ball of crack and taunt crackheads with it.
What would you do for this?
He'd ask, and then just laugh in his weird way, without opening his mouth very wide. He could be funny and menacing at the same time.
I used to think his voice was crazy, said MC Ren.
He called my brother, and he'd be like, Hey, Charlie,
in his little voice. Before becoming a dealer, Eric worked some dead-end jobs. He considered going out for the post office like his old man, even taking the civil service test. But that life wasn't for him.
I hate working for somebody else, he said.
Eric and his family didn't have tons of money growing up, but they never lacked. His parents taught him to be a self-starter, though they probably didn't intend for him to be a drug dealer. He had a vision to succeed, so when it came to his drug business, he didn't fool around. He only worked with the people he trusted. A typical day might start with him prepping his stash of cocaine in the garage and getting into his bolt-length 1973 Chevy Caprice, maroon with a white vinyl top, called a glass house for the long mirrors surrounding the cabin. It wasn't the only slick car Eric owned. At various points in the 80s, he also drove a Nissan truck,
a pink Suzuki Jeep with candy paint, and Volkswagen Bugs, including one of 1960s vintage with "The Freaks Come Out at Night" decaled on the back window, in honor of Brooklyn rap group Houdini's hit song. Eric would pilot the Caprice less than a mile over to Atlantic Drive, pulling up where East Caldwell Street came to a dead end. This was a particularly dangerous gang nexus controlled by the Atlantic Drive Compton Crips, with other sets including the Neighborhood Crips, the Kelly Park Crips, and the South Side Crips all nearby. All wanted to grow their drug businesses. "It was a powder keg," said CPO Boss Hogg. The Crips were established in South Central in 1969 by muscle-bound teenager Raymond Washington, who enlisted a fearsome high school friend named Stanley Tukey Williams. They formed an alliance to battle other local gangs.
"I thought, I can cleanse the neighborhood of all these, you know, marauding gangs," Williams said. "But I was totally wrong. And eventually we morphed into the monster we were addressing."
In 1979, Williams was convicted of murder and was put to death by lethal injection in 2005. Washington, who hated guns but loved to scrap,
"Raymond would take his shirt off and fight his ass off all day long,"
an acquaintance said, was murdered in 1979. Adopting their signature color blue, in the early 70s, the Crips attempted to expand their turf into Compton, which had its own neighborhood sets. Guys living on and around Piru Street near Centennial High School banded together to defend themselves, forming the Pirus. The group included Sylvester Scott and Benson Owens, who are credited with founding the Bloods, which enveloped sets including the Brims and the Bounty Hunters from the Nickerson Gardens housing projects in Watts. They took red as their color, owing to the fact that the Pirus were called Roosters, the Bounty Hunters were called Blobs, and the Brims used to put red-stemmed matches in their hats. Both sects splintered and mutated across the country, and their rivalry, sometimes among their own members, became increasingly bloody. By the time Eric became a young man, the Crips and the Bloods, along with Latino gangs, had divided up Compton between them and were on their way to taking over the region. It's not hard to understand the appeal. In neighborhoods where there's no work, high crime, and crumbling family structures, joining forces with other disillusioned kids helped create pride and a sense of unity. But along with pride and unity came violence. In 1984, there were about 200 gangland killings in L.A. County. 1988 saw almost 500, and by the early 1990s, an estimated 100,000 gang members were spread across the county. It's not entirely clear which Crip subset Eric represented. The gang hadn't yet fully splintered, and really most of the Crip factions in his part of town liked Eric. It didn't hurt that he sold them high-quality coke and at great prices. But that didn't make him a serious gangbanger. Sure, he sometimes wore blue, but he didn't do drive-bys, and he didn't seek retribution against other sets. That wasn't how he rolled. He was about his money. Pure and simple. Atlantic Drive was the name of an apartment building out of which he sometimes operated, and also the name of its street. The unglamorous two-story stucco spot housed a few dozen families, but it was especially effective as a 24-hour drug market. Its C-shaped layout prevented most of the units from being seen from the street, which meant interested buyers could approach without fear of police observation. Buyers could get everything from crack and angel dust to weed or Sherman, marijuana joints or Nat Sherman cigarettes dipped in PCP. Though there was plenty of foot traffic, the building managed to keep something of a low profile. After making purchases, buyers were quickly escorted out. No smoking on the premises. It was the perfect dealing zone. Gangs were involved with the drug trade, but there was little established hierarchy. "If someone saw you were a hustler, they'd front you some," said rapper J.D., who dealt on Compton's Poinsettia Avenue. "It was always on consignment, and everyone had a beeper and one of those big brick phones.
You'd put it in your pocket, and your pants fell off. Dealers would keep their supplies at a stash house, a spot inhabited by a drug addict, whom they'd pay in crack, maybe a gram a day. We called them the house man or the house lady, said J.D., adding that he felt no guilt about selling people such a noxious drug. Our philosophy was, we didn't put a gun to their head. J.D., who went on to fame as a member of Ice Cube's group, the Lynch Mob, specialized in curb serving, selling to people hand-to-hand on the street like a drive-through Taco Bell. Customers included anyone from McDonnell Douglas employees who drove over from Long Beach to addicts from the neighborhood. He kept his money between his insole and the bottom of his shoe. That way you could run away with it. And once he made $1,000, he would take it home and come back fresh. Eric didn't do deals with just anyone on the street. He sold wholesale, and only to clients he knew, including cousins working out of the Atlantic Drive apartments. If he recognized a number on his pager, he'd call back on a payphone. Of course you needed to know the codes. For an 8-ball, an eighth of an ounce, the page should include an 8. The code for a half ounce, meanwhile, was 12. If something felt off, Eric simply didn't do the deal. One slip-up could mean the end. Compton hustlers didn't play around. Eric only had to remember Horace Butler. The Windfall. Horace Butler was Eric's first cousin once removed, and the spitting image of the rapper Buffy from the Fat Boys. Schoolmates teased Butler constantly about his weight as a kid.
So he'd been toughened up, his friend Mark Rucker said. If you kicked him or tripped him, he'd bust you square in the face.
He lived nearby on Poinsettia and served as Eric's mentor in the drug game. If you stayed on his good side, Butler was generous. He was secretive, however, and you had to earn his confidence. Eric, though, was his trusted kin. When he was a teenager, Butler made him his runner, charged with delivering dope to the customers after Butler made the deals. Eric, who dropped out of Dominguez High School, hadn't known much about the drug business until then. As a teenager, he'd taken joyrides in stolen cars. He'd done burglaries. He stole color televisions and VCRs.
One time he wanted to give his mother a stolen TV as a present, Big A remembered with a laugh.
When it came to dealing, though, Eric was a novice, which is why he was surprised when one day in 1984, Butler invited him to go for a ride in his truck. Eric climbed into Butler's ride, a candy-painted GMC truck, chromed out with big rims on its off-road tires. Technically speaking, the truck didn't belong to Butler, but to another guy from the area who'd been sent to jail. The truck had been impounded, and the rumor was that it was full of packages of Sherman. No one wanted to retrieve it for fear that the police would arrest them. But Butler didn't care. He managed to secure the truck's release, and the big, beautiful GMC was now his. With Eric in tow, Butler drove it to a secret neighborhood location away from prying eyes. Butler looked around, making sure no one was watching, and then reached his hands beneath the side of an abandoned house, retrieving a paper grocery bag. He pulled it open and revealed its contents to Eric. Bundle upon bundle of cash, tightly bound by rubber bands into squares.
Keep an eye on this for me, he said, putting it back.
Eric didn't know what to make of this, but he quickly consented. Around that time, Butler was acting strange in other ways, too. Rucker noticed it earlier that week as he worked his drug spot nearby on Glencoe Street, a stone's throw from the home of a mutual friend, M.O. Moses, who had just hanged himself in his garage. As police and the coroner dealt with the body, a crowd gathered. Butler and Rucker chatted, lamenting the death for a few minutes, before the latter got down to business. Rucker was in the market for some product.
Do you have some? He asked.
Nah, said Butler, surveying the area. I'm laying low, taking a break. Why is that?
Things are kind of funny right now.
The men parted ways, making plans to see each other at Moses' funeral, for which Rucker was to be a pallbearer. He had even rented a suit for the occasion. But Butler wouldn't make it. A few days later, just after midnight, he was driving his truck in mid-city L.A., about to enter onto the 10 freeway with a passenger in tow. As he pulled up to the signal light, he was shot 7 times by his own passenger, who promptly jumped out. Its driver now dead, the truck slowly rolled backward before hitting a pole and coming to a stop. The murder left a trail of questions. Who was this person? Why did he or she murder Horace Butler? Was it about money? The truck? Drugs? Only one truth was known. There would be another funeral in Compton that week.
Butler's death hit Eric hard. "Me and him used to be together every day," he said. "I just happened to go off and do some business with my mother that night, and I wasn't there. I figure I was there, I'd probably be dead right along with him."
Eric would quickly have another shock. When he returned to the abandoned house where Butler had stashed his bag of cash, he found not only the money, but parcel after parcel of cocaine as well. Eric quickly realized he was sitting on top of a gold mine. Even if you didn't consider the cash, there had to be tens of thousands of dollars worth of product here. He just had to figure out how to unload the stuff. He immediately got to work. When Rucker arrived, not long afterward, at Eric's house, Rucker was astonished to find Eric crouched over a small electric stove, trying to figure out how to cook up crack.
"Man, where'd you get this from?" Rucker asked.
"I went to get the money," Eric said, "and this was there too."
Eric's inexperience was quickly evident. He cut a rock and held it up to Rucker, speculating on its value.
"This is a 20, right?"
"Hell no," said Rucker.
The rock was closer to $60. Rucker proceeded to give him a crash course in how to price crack rocks. From then on, Rucker began buying his cocaine from Eric. His prices were great. $1,000 for an ounce, an amount for which others might charge $1,500. Eric even gave him parcels on consignment. He could afford it, considering these inherited wares amounted to pure profit. In 1985, as the recipient of a windfall, Eric appeared to be riding high. Having invested profits from Butler's stash into his own supplies, he had fine clothes and fancy cars. But he wasn't satisfied. Deep down, he knew this wasn't the life for him, and so he decided to do something about it. An historically dangerous place. Day-to-day life in Compton didn't mesh with Hollywood's version of gangland. In the daylight hours of the mid-1980s, the city, located about 10 miles south of downtown L.A., still looked like a middle-class suburb. Well-appointed multicolored bungalows had big yards, iron bars on windows, and wrought iron fences. Kids rode around on bicycles, clothes billowed on lines, and working-class brown and black people went about their business. Late at night, teenagers would race their Suzuki trucks and VW bugs for cash, but it didn't seem like a war zone. Beneath the surface, however, bubbled the makings of urban catastrophe. High unemployment, poverty, and infant mortality, and rising gang murders. The recession of the 1970s had been eased by Nixon's Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, a public jobs program that put people in the neighborhood to work. In 1982, Reagan gutted it, making it harder for locals to find jobs. The police weren't much help either. Until it was disbanded in 2000, Compton had its own police force, one of the most corrupt in the nation. The city of only 93,000 people had 66 killings in 1986 and 85 in 1987, more than 3 times the per capita rate of L.A. as a whole, which was then itself an historically dangerous place.
Los Angeles during the 80s counted almost 3,000 gang-related killings. A black teen was 6 times as likely to be murdered as his white counterpart. Eric Wright's parents arrived in Compton from Greenville, Mississippi, as part of the Great Migration. Los Angeles was the main embarkation point for World War II soldiers headed off to the South Pacific, and following the war, plentiful aerospace jobs drew people from all over the country. The gorgeous weather didn't hurt. Eric's parents were among the first black families in Compton. For most of the 20th century, the city was lily white. For a short time in 1949, George and Barbara Bush lived in a Compton apartment complex while he sold oil drilling equipment. Compton was also notoriously racist. Though the Supreme Court outlawed housing racial segregation in 1917, developers and banks continued to systematically enforce it. A real estate broker could lose her license for aiding integration, and Compton was hit harder by this trend than any other part of LA. Meanwhile, violent vigilante groups sought to hold black families off at the city's border, espousing the slogan, "Keep the Negroes north of 130th Street." Marvin Kinsey, a black Compton native and veteran Piru gang member born in 1950, recalled being told not to cross Wilmington Avenue past 7 p.m. for fear of Minutemen and spook hunters. He added that, when he was 9, 4 young white men in a 57 Ford pulled up asking for directions. When he approached their car, they pelted him with rotten eggs and tomatoes. Following a Supreme Court decision in 1948 that made the systematic discrimination increasingly unworkable, housing restrictions were eased. The Wrights settled in Compton, where Eric was born in 1964. Not far away, the Watts riots followed a year later, after a black motorist was pulled over by a white highway patrolman on suspicion of drunk driving, stoking civil unrest, dozens of deaths, and then unprecedented property damage. In the aftermath, white flight and factory closings began to change the area. The former Bush residents eventually attracted drug dealers, squatters, and prostitutes, and Compton became one of the most dangerous cities in the country. Anyone in Los Angeles who wanted a cheap high during the early Reagan years just had to visit South Central's vast open-air drug market called The Track, located on 81st Street between Hoover and Vermont. Sherman was initially popular, but before long, crack cocaine was all the rage. You can only snort so much coke before your nose bleeds, but you can smoke crack all day and still want more. "You saw respectable men turn into crackheads," said Ice Cube. "You saw the nurse up the street with the family turn into a strawberry." That is, a woman selling herself for the drug. Initially quite expensive and known as Ready Rock, since it had already been freebased with baking soda and was ready to smoke, crack prices began to fall thanks to the efforts of dealers like South Central trafficker Freeway Rick Ross. He sent out guys on mopeds to make deliveries all over the area, and by the mid-80s was moving, literally, tons of cocaine. Marvin Kinsey saw the effects of crack in Compton firsthand. He was stunned to see a prominent community member, a man who had owned a bank and a car wash, pushing a shopping cart down the street one day. He smoked his entire empire away. Little did crack customers know that they were helping fund a Central American war. One of Ross's Nicaraguan suppliers, Oscar Danilo Blandon, received protection from the CIA as he channeled his profits to the rebel Contras working to overthrow the leftist Sandinista government. The Reagan administration also supported the rebels and funded them through secret weapon sales to Iran, resulting in the Iran-Contra scandal. Blandon was eventually arrested and worked undercover for the U.S. government when he ensnared Ross, who served 13 years in prison. In 1989, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, led by John Kerry, then a first-term senator from Massachusetts, released a report concluding that senior U.S. policymakers, We're not immune to the idea that drug money was a perfect solution to the Contras' funding problems. The CIA may not have directly funneled crack into the inner city, as is sometimes alleged, but they appear to have turned a blind eye toward it, as it suited their geopolitical aims. Before crack, gangs weren't particularly profitable, but members quickly realized the big money in the drug game. They started to say, "I can have nice cars, I can have a house, I can wear nice clothes," said Freeway Rick Ross. So then they got involved. For a while, police were ignorant. They looked for PCP on their raids, not coke. But by 1986, mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines were established, making punishment for crack possession far stricter than cocaine. Blacks weren't using more than whites, but police found it a lot easier to roll up on a group of corner dealers as opposed to kicking in somebody's Beverly Hills door. Los Angeles police employed brutal tactics to break up the rising tides of gang membership, drug use, and violent crime. The LAPD's CRASH unit, which stood for Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, employed its Operation Hammer, far-reaching sweeps across South Central in which police rounded up and arrested thousands of presumed gang members. Many were ultimately found to be unaffiliated. CRASH police often carried a throwaway gun or extra dope to plant on suspects. "They swallow the dope or throw it away, so we beat them up and use our own," one said. "They're illegal. They're selling dope, so what kind of respect do we owe them? That's wrong, but it's how we thought about it." In January 1988, a 27-year-old woman named Karen Toshima was killed in Westwood Village, caught in a crossfire between rival gangs. Though gang-related murders were nothing new, in the wake of Toshima's killing in a well-off neighborhood, Mayor Tom Bradley and the city council agreed to spring for millions for a surge in patrols. President Reagan declared the war on drugs in 1982, and Police Chief Daryl Gates, head of the beleaguered, understaffed LAPD, took a particularly hard line on drug users. In 1990, he told a Senate committee that those who blast some pot on a casual basis ought to be taken out and shot. One dramatic tool of the Gates administration was the battering ram, an armored tank weighing 6 tons and bearing a 14-foot steel arm that crushed doorways of suspected rock houses. It inspired a hit song by Compton rapper Toddy T. Batter Ram, which includes uncredited production work by a young Dr. Dre. In April 1989, just-displaced First Lady Nancy Reagan, now living with Ronald in Bel Air, suited up in an LAPD windbreaker and tennis shoes to observe a raid of a suspected South Central drug house near Main Street and 51st. Alongside Chief Gates, she watched as a SWAT team busted in. Reagan, who coined the phrase, "just say no," said she found the sparsely furnished house very depressing. Equally depressing, perhaps, was the fact that only 1.5 grams of crack were seized, yet 14 people were arrested. Media accounts of the incident noted that the Nancy Reagan Drug Rehabilitation Center was slated to open later that year in the San Fernando Valley. But that never happened, as Reagan abruptly withdrew her support for it over the summer, scuttling $5 million in donations. Her spokesman explained to the Los Angeles Times she was spreading herself too thin. Ordinary South Los Angeles residents couldn't be blamed for fearing the cops as much as the criminals. Greg Mack of hip-hop station K-Day recalled regular gunfire and ghetto bird helicopters constantly overhead at his South Central home searching for perpetrators. "Because my wife at the time was Hispanic, we always got pulled over," said Mac, who was black. "They always thought I was up to no good, that I was riding around with a girl of a different race like I was a pimp." "They shoot people in the back," MC Ren said. "They beat your ass for nothing." Nearly every L.A. black man I interviewed for this book has stories like these, being pulled over for minor or non-existent infractions, being humiliated, being arrested unfairly. It was just a fact of life. Los Angeles hip-hop scene rose amid this chaos. The music itself was warm and friendly, at least at first. Local MCs rapped over soft, danceable beats. DJs spun New York rappers' records at clubs and house parties. Members of car clubs, say for Nissan trucks or VW bugs, blasted cassette mixes. Venice Beach breakdancers spun on cardboard. Some drug dealers invested their profits in local talent like Compton hip-hop titan Mixmaster Spade, who learned DJing while attending school in New York and returned home to rock parties and foster emerging L.A. rap talent, including King T, Toddy T, Coolio, and DJ Pooh. That is, until Spade was arrested following a 1987 shootout with police who found a giant quantity of PCP on the property. A hip-hop show at the Long Beach Arena the summer previous descended into chaos. Headliners Run-DMC never performed because a fight broke out. K-Day programmer Greg Mack, on stage, saw a man get thrown over a balcony. He somehow survived. Assailants weaponized broken chair legs and yanked off young girls' necklaces. Security was overwhelmed and dozens were injured. "It was a race riot," said popular DJ Roger Clayton, who promoted and attended the show. "The Long Beach Insanes had stole a Mexican girl's purse, and some Mexican dudes went upstairs, broke in the broom closet, and went down and hit up the Long Beach Insanes. Hit 'em with brooms and mops and sticks with sharp edges on 'em. Then all the black gangs got together that was out there, and they just started whooping every Mexican boy, every white boy, throwing 'em off the second level, whooping they ass and everything." Some critics, like Parents Music Resource Center crusader Tipper Gore, People magazine noted, believe there is a subliminal message in rap music, that it's okay to beat people up. But reality was more complicated. For many kids, hip-hop represented a way out, a constructive way to make a living. Performer Alonzo Williams received a pass because he DJed. "I was in East L.A. doing a backyard party, and two Latino gangs got to fighting," he said. "But they called a timeout to stop the fight. 'Let the DJ go home. He's not in this shit, man.' Both gangs helped me load my truck up with my equipment." Chapter 2. Sir Romeo. A tall, broad-shouldered high school student in the early 80s, Andre Young was already a ladies' man, making the girls laugh and wowing them with his hip-hop prowess. His DJ group, Freak Patrol, pumped out jams at parties, and his pop-locking routine during halftime at Fremont High School football games drew cheers. Performed to a breathy electro beat, the robotic dance featured stutter steps and abrupt stops and starts, popping out one's limbs before locking them in place. His outfit included rubber-soled Bruce Lee-style shoes and a customized Batman-style black jacket with a little cape in the back and his nickname, Sir Romeo, ironed on, a play on his middle name, Rommel. Another favorite spot to show off was Eve After Dark, a club near Compton and Willowbrook, frequented by Natalie-dressed young adults. The meaning of the club's name is a little hard to parse. Something to do with original sin. But folks lined up to get in. The disco era wasn't too far gone, and a mirror ball spun above the dance floor while DJs pumped out groovy R&B, funk, rap, and electro. It was like Eden before the snake. No alcohol was served, just sodas. Club owner Alonzo Williams didn't allow gang attire, preferring his male clientele adhere to the sartorial stylings of Morris Day, slacks, hard-bottom shoes, and a skinny tie. Girls might arrive with their hair in a bun, but then shake it out in the bathroom. Before they leave, they'd wrap it back up and, when they got home, would be like, "Hi, Mom," said Lonzo. Andre's mother would drop him off with his brother Tyree and their friends, and then go home and get some sleep, setting her alarm for 1 a.m. to come pick them up. Inside the club, Andre might juggle conversations with two or three women at a time, with a wingman running interference so nobody got suspicious. At age 16, he had his first child with a woman named Cassandra Joy Green, a boy named Curtis whom he didn't acknowledge until decades later. He also began talking to a pretty 14-year-old student named Lisa Johnson. Raised in South Central, Johnson more recently lived on the west side of L.A. Her dad was out of the picture and her brother had been killed in gang violence. Andre seduced her when she was in ninth grade, she said, but their relationship was controversial from the start. Johnson's mother thought she was too young to be dating, so the pair met secretly. Then, one day, I received that phone call. The call that all moms of teenagers dread, wrote Andre's mother Verna Griffin in her memoir. Johnson was pregnant. She started 10th grade at Fremont, but only lasted a couple of weeks. I was pregnant and they didn't want me on school campus, she said. To make things worse, Johnson's mother was furious at her daughter for the pregnancy. She threw Johnson out of the house. It was January 1983 when Johnson gave birth to their first daughter, LaTanya. Johnson was 15, and Andre was 17. He was a real proud father at the time, Johnson said. Andre's mother let Johnson and the baby live with them for a time. Johnson slept in Andre's bedroom, while he slept in the living room. They also stayed with his grandmother in Willowbrook, not far from Eve after dark. Sometimes they found themselves crashing at grim motels like the Snooty Fox Motor Inn on Southwestern Avenue, which rents rooms by the hour. Before long, however, Andre had gotten another young woman pregnant, named Lavetta Washington. Their girl Tyra was born in May 1984. Johnson was furious. She, too, was pregnant again. Andre Young's accomplished, elegant mother Verna Griffin has created a clothing line and published her memoir in 2008. She's also tough as nails. One night in Los Angeles when she was a young mother, two men attempted to mug her, rolling up and demanding her purse. Without hesitation, I pulled out my gun and aimed it at them, she wrote. They sped away. She and Andre's father, Theodore Young, were still in high school when they had him, just months before the 1965 Watts riots. They quickly married at Verna's mother's insistence and rented a home on 135th Street from Theodore's stepfather. The price was right, $18 a week, but unemployment pushed Theodore into drug dealing. To Verna's distress, his clients would get high at their home. The stale odor of marijuana was so strong that not even daily cleaning could get rid of it, she wrote. Not long after, she and Andre moved back into her parents' home in an unincorporated part of L.A. County near Compton. Theodore was soon arrested in a drug raid. She claimed he beat her during their tumultuous marriage. If I went to the neighborhood store and stayed too long, he would get physical with me, Verna wrote. If I engaged in what he considered a prolonged conversation with any of his male companions, he would get physical with me. I could not reach Theodore Young for comment. Verna added that he also beat her when she was pregnant with her second child, Jerome Levante Young, who died during infancy from unrelated intestinal pneumonia. He began stalking her so badly that she was scared to leave her house, she wrote. Smart and resourceful despite dropping out of school after ninth grade, Verna held down low-paying jobs at stores like National Dollar, Sears, and Kmart. Poverty was never far from her young family's door, and they didn't always have access to a phone, a car, or even gas. Verna had yet another boy die in infancy, and she herself nearly died from the birth of Andre's younger brother Tyree when doctors failed to remove her placenta. She also gave birth to a healthy girl named Shamika. Constant moving characterized Andre's childhood. At one point, the family lived near the Compton Airport in a housing project called Wilmington Arms, which the LA Times later called so notorious as a drug bazaar that one city councilman says it should be demolished. Verna and her brood moved well over a dozen times, hopscotching among apartments and houses in South Central, Watts, Carson, Long Beach, and Compton, including on Thorson Avenue in the latter city, just a few blocks away from Eric Wright. These neighborhoods were rough, with bullies on the block, burglars at the door, and once a man murdered right in front of their house. Another time, Verna recalled, after two nursery school children got into a dispute, their mothers settled things by fighting each other with knives. They were sometimes on government assistance, and when Andre was 11, the family suffered a bad car accident. Andre's face was severely cut up by smashed glass. He barely complained, even though more than a month later, he was found to have suffered a broken collarbone. "He handled the pain from his injury so well," Verna wrote. "I wondered if that was because I had taught him the importance of enduring pain." Tyree and Little Warren. Having finally split from Theodore, Verna met her future husband, Curtis Crayon, at a beach party. Their relationship soon turned rocky as well. Following their divorce, he harassed me with threats of violence, she wrote, and she procured a restraining order. But the product of their marriage, son Tyree Deshaun Crayon, who was 3 years younger than Andre, would become Andre's greatest supporter and confidant. Tyree played football, basketball, and track, and was the first person in the family to graduate from high school. He found work with an aerospace company and fathered a boy. "My brother was my best friend, and we did everything together. He was just a lot of fun to be around. He walked in, the party got live," Andre said. Verna married a third time to a corporate-level McDonnell Douglas employee from Long Beach named Warren Griffin Jr. The families joined forces Brady Bunch style, with all 8 kids living under one roof at times. The brood included Warren Griffin III, a quiet, bespectacled kid who would become famous as rapper-producer Warren G. Warren Griffin Jr. was a Mason, as well as a karate master who taught Andre Warren and Tyree how to defend themselves. Some weekends, Big Warren loaded the entire squirrely lot into his Ford station wagon and took them to the drive-in. Verna, meanwhile, developed an interest in fashion design and enlisted the kids for her shows. Clad in Miami Vice-style duds, Tyree clowned around on the runway while Andre spun R&B or jazz on the turntables. "We would all model," Warren G said. Verna eventually got her own store at the Carson Mall, and Andre's new girlfriend, Michelle A., an up-and-coming R&B singer, came to help promote it, signing autographs. The family was thick, even through tough times, living off powdered eggs during a McDonnell Douglas strike. Warren G. worshipped his older stepbrothers. Andre and Tyree called him Kibbles. "Because my hair was nappy like Kibbles and Bits," he said. They hung out at nearby Kelly Park, Eric Wright's gang territory. Kids taunted Little Warren because he was originally from Long Beach, and so his stepbrothers taught him how to defend himself. "They would sick me on the little dudes when one of them would get to running off at the mouth," Warren G. said. "Get 'em, Kibbles!" Rap Talker. Owing to bad grades, Andre left Centennial High School, located in Compton, for Fremont, which was in South Central. But even after transferring, his academic performance didn't improve, and as a result he was booted from the diving team. Still, his instructors saw promise. "His English teacher said, 'I know he's not a dummy. I watch him play chess at lunchtime and he beats everybody,'" wrote Verna. Skilled at drawing, he enjoyed mechanical drafting, which is used to illustrate HVAC systems in construction and architecture plans. A teacher encouraged him to pursue it, but in the end, he dropped out of Fremont. He battled with his mother about his future. She insisted he return to school or get a regular job. But Andre's great passion was music, Damn everything else. Verna should have known better. It was their great bond. She performed as part of an act called The Four Aces, who wrote original compositions for piano, and Andre's middle name, Rommel, was taken from his father's neighborhood singing group, the Rommels. Verna boasted a tremendous record collection, and as a child, Andre controlled the stylus at her parties. Even before he could read, he learned to recognize 45s by their label colors. "Everybody in my neighborhood loved music," he added. "I could jump the back fence and be in the park where there were ghetto blasters everywhere." Verna was especially into 70s funk. Earth, Wind & Fire, Parliament Funkadelic, James Brown, Isaac Hayes. Andre grew up listening to it too. Attending an L.A. Coliseum concert featuring Parliament Funkadelic as a 14-year-old, his mind was blown. He stood mouth agape as a spaceship descended, and George Clinton led his band in madcap exuberant fashion. Then and there, Andre decided to pursue a life of music. "Before I heard them, I was planning to be a mechanical draftsman," he later wrote in the Los Angeles Times. "But P-Funk's music opened my mind up to the idea that there are no barriers except the ones you believe in." The funk became the defining music of his life, the foundation of his creations. Andre would learn to play piano and read sheet music, but was particularly blessed by an incredible ear for sounds that went together. Upon receiving a mixer one Christmas, he taught himself how to incorporate a component of one song with a component of another. "This was like the ultimate thing to have," Andre said. "Damn a bike! I got a mixer!" In the 70s and early 80s, DJs were the stars of hip-hop. When rappers joined in, they served largely to hype the turntablists. Ice-T was one of L.A.'s first popular rappers, and his early song, Reckless, is basically an extended shout-out to his DJ, Chris the Glove Taylor. "The DJ named Glove has reigned supreme as the turntable wizard of the hip-hop scene." Reckless is part of the Breakin' soundtrack, a 1984 hip-hop film featuring pop-locking galore. The MCs are almost an afterthought. In the credits, Ice-T is listed as the rap talker. Early hip-hop was performed mostly live at parties, and when artists first began recording in studios, they worked to recreate the festive atmosphere. As Sugar Hill Gang's Big Bang Hank put it, "Hotel, motel, Holiday Inn." Before long, groups like Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five ushered in socio-political themes like on their 1982 hit, The Message. And by the mid-80s, hip-hop, with aggressive-sounding backing tracks, was in full force in New York. Run DMC and LL Cool J spat over hard beats, and the MC, rather than the DJ, began to dominate. But LA hadn't gotten the memo. There, the party vibe marched on. A faster-paced, heavily synthesized electro-dance DJ sound, with vocoder-altered robotic vocals, still ruled dance floors. Folks weren't interested in sophisticated rapping so much as getting down. Popular DJs like Egyptian Lover made what sounds today like techno music. On the turntables, he'd manipulate records to play a drum beat or song section three times in a row. Boom, boom, boom. Egyptian Lover joined a mobile DJ crew called Uncle Jam's Army, who brought their audio equipment wherever there was a party. Group leader Roger Clayton had a swagadelic persona and a knack for promotion, signing up kids for mailing lists and sending out postcards. Uncle Jam's Army was influenced by Afrika Bambaataa, a pioneering New York DJ and former member of Violent Bronx street gang, the Black Spades, who broke off to start the hip-hop-focused Universal Zulu Nation movement. At the time of this writing, April 2016, Bambaataa was facing allegations from multiple men that he sexually abused them as minors, allegations he strenuously denied. His song, Planet Rock, which borrowed from the music of German electronic music pioneers Kraftwerk, became a dance floor spectacular upon its 1982 release. Uncle Jam's extravagant electronic affairs took a page from Bambata's and were wildly popular in the early 80s, with the group performing at spots like Veterans Memorial Auditorium in Culver City before graduating to the LA Sports Arena. There they performed before upward of 5,000 kids, girls in bandanas and miniskirts, and young African-American mods dancing in a ska style, wearing trench coats. In the mode of Run DMC and the Fat Boys, attending B-boys wore oversized Kazaa glasses and thick braided gold chains known as dookie ropes. The ear-drumming annihilating arsenal was part of the advertising. Uncle Jam's flyer for a 1983 sports arena show promised 100 speakers, which were stacked like pyramids. Dressed in leather and spikes, coonskin caps, or like Middle Eastern snake charmers, they'd shoot fog and throw fire. Their DJs ranks included Egyptian lover DJ Pooh, Keith Cooley, the half-brother of innovative turntablist Joe Cooley, and Bobcat, who returned from a stint on the East Coast with a mastery of the Philadelphia Transformer sound, whose name was taken from the shape-changing Transformer action figures. These shows were less like concerts and more like what we think of today as raves, with DJs playing continuous hits to keep the party moving. Though Uncle Jam's played rap songs, they did not usually feature rappers, however.
"It would get boring," Roger Clayton said. "We can put rappers on no more than 2 minutes a night because they interfere with the energy level."
Disco Lonzo. Although he could hardly be less gangster, Alonzo Williams is the unsung architect of the gangster rap era. A go-along-to-get-along guy 8 years Andre Young senior, Williams emerged on the mobile DJ scene spinning disco and R&B in flamboyant costumes. Raised in Compton and sent to Catholic school, he was first known as Disco Lonzo, clad in a Superman shirt, whistle, construction hat with a siren, and, around his neck, a gold chain reading Lonzo with an attached razor blade to cut up his cocaine. He was like Disco Stew from The Simpsons, said his collaborator, the unknown DJ. Lonzo recruited help to set up and break down or wreck his equipment each night, birthing the name of his group, World Class Wrecking Crew, which featured a rotating cast of DJs. Lonzo's dad hooked him up with the owner of Eve After Dark, and the young entrepreneur began throwing parties there in 1979. He promoted a Super Freak contest in which women could win $100 by doing extremely erotic moves to make the crowd excited. He even brought in male exotic dancers to a storefront downstairs. "They're a lot less hassle than female dancers," he explained. Andre Young started coming to Eve After Dark on the weekends, and the club gave him his first break one night in 1982. Somehow maneuvering himself up on stage, he worked two turntables, proceeding to blow the crowd's minds by mixing 1961 doo-wop classic Please Mr. Postman by the Marvelettes with Afrika Bambaataa's Planet Rock. This was long before computer software made this kind of thing easy. "One record is twice as fast as the other, so all of the beats won't match." "But it worked," Lonzo said. "That was a masterpiece to pull off." Andre would manually record songs straight off the radio and layer them together with a four-track recorder. The crude technique let him bring to life mashups he'd imagined. "You might hear Oh Sheila by Ready for the World, but the vocals would be a Prince song, and the harmony would be a whole other artist," said K-Day programmer Greg Mack. "People would say, 'Oh, he's not a real DJ.' I'd be like, 'I don't care what you call it. Shit sounds good.'" "Where normally you go to a club and the DJs play all the hit records back to back, I used to put on a serious show," Andre said. He began calling himself Dr. Dre, after basketball star Julius Dr. J. Irving, sometimes tacking on to his handle, the Master of Mixology. Lonzo paid him $50 per night to perform and invited him to join the World Class Wrecking Crew. He also provided him access to first-rate recording equipment, including his top-of-the-line 4-track bass and drum machine. The newly minted Dr. Dre also linked up with K-Day, the Echo Park-based AM station with a fuzzy signal that was the first in the world